Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Matt from Spectology, and we are going to be talking about Down Below Station by C.J. Cherry, which won the 1982 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Matt, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Seth, for having me. This is terrific.
It's my pleasure. You've been nice enough to have me on your podcast a couple times, so had to return the favor.
Yeah, that was really fun.
And it's cool to get the other side of Spectology on the podcast here.
Oh, yeah, because Adrian, my other half, has already been on your show. And that was really fun for me to listen to. I'm glad to join in.
Cool. Well, since Adrian's already been on, we don't necessarily have to talk about Spectology, but I'd like to, get some of your background. Like, what's your nerdy history?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been into, reading science fiction and fantasy and doing nerdy stuff since I was very, very small. I think my dad showed me the first, Star Wars movie, A New Hope. Mm-hmm. When I was, six. And because he's into that stuff too. My dad reads a lot of science fiction. So that's kind of the obvious.
I did the same with my son. So
that's perfect. Yeah. Good choice. So that's the sort of obvious origin story there. I've always been into it. I think as I got older, I got more into more and more different kinds. And so at this point, I try to be expansive as possible in how I understand what science fiction is. And that's something we try to do on Spectology. When I was little, maybe I only read books with spaceships on them. But as I've gotten older, I've just gotten interested in more things. And when I was in university, I studied literature from China. I was a Chinese major and I studied a lot of literature from there and then from other places too. And I've gotten very interested in a sort of wider range of things. So we try on our podcast to kind of be really broad about what we mean by that. And so, and we also try to read a lot of, somewhat newer things. And so it's really cool to get to read the old classics with you. Cause obviously I grew up with it and it's really fun. Although there's a lot of Hugo winners I've never read. So that's also a cool thing.
Yeah. Now with your Chinese language skills, I mean, have you read something like The Three-Body Problem actually in Mandarin?
I have read Chinese science fiction novels. In fact, we did one in Chinese. In fact, we did one on our podcast last year. We did Huang Tao by Chen Qiufan, which is called The Waste Tide in English. And that was really great. And I've read other Chinese science fiction in Chinese, but I've never read Three Body in Chinese or in English. Oh. I've never read it at all, actually.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of an odd thing when you think about it, but it's actually mostly because I want to read it in Chinese and that takes me longer, slower. Yeah. I read more slowly in Chinese than in English by a considerable margin. So I just have to budget more time and I've never actually done that. And so it's just kind of keeps getting put off, but hopefully, soon.
did you watch The Wandering Earth on Netflix?
No, I haven't because I don't want spoilers. I want to. I always have this argument with Adrian about spoilers. I am the sort of person who I like to go in knowing absolutely nothing, if possible, about what I'm going to read. But I definitely would. I love sci-fi movies too.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the nice thing about The Wandering Earth is it's just a short story. Mm-hmm. So it's not a full length novel.
Yeah, but I can be. This is part of the source of the argument that I have with Adrian about spoilers. Is that I can be kind of strict about what counts as a spoiler to me,
right?
So even world building stuff is, I try to go in totally blank slate if I can.
Gotcha. All right, I'll say no more.
Thank you.
No, so one thing I really like about Spectology, I do like the fact that it's a nice complement to where on my podcast, we're mostly jumping in the Wayback Machine, right? There's some more modern Hugo winners, of course, but we're, covering stuff from all the way back into the 50s and even further back for some of the retro Hugos, where you guys are covering more up-to-date stuff. The only bummer is, I don't have that much bandwidth for reading new stuff. And so it's a rare episode of yours that I get to read, that I get to listen to the post-read.
Yeah,
so I'll listen to a lot of the pre-reads and go, okay, I'll add that to the list for if I ever have time. But it was cool actually, and I'll refer people to your kind of year in review that you guys recently posted, and I really like that you guys are conscious of pulling from diverse sources, mm-hmm. right? Not just reading stuff by a bunch of old white guys. And, you know, when you look at the Hugo list, it's a lot of old white guys. In this case, it's a white lady. So,
We definitely try to, I mean, there's always more we could do. I think one of the things that we talked about when we talked about our 2019 in review stuff is kind of how well we did according to mm-hmm. us. And obviously we solicit feedback from people we know and stuff about that too. It's not, but, you know, it's, I don't think it's possible to ever feel like I at least sort of feel, you know, kind of constantly that it's kind of never enough, and not in a bad way, but just in like a, there's always a lot more to learn, and like there's always right. You know, progress to make. So I don't want to
So for me, with and this is, you know, take this as a personal appeal, listener, if you're out there, my reading list can't be super diverse just because of the nature of I'm going with this list, right? And so I would mm-hmm. love to have a more diverse cast of guests. And the fact is that, you know, a lot of people that I interact with are just other white people. And so if you're out there and you're a nerd of color and you want to come on here, let me know.
Yeah.
Because that'd be awesome. So anyhow, we'll end that appeal and start moving into actually talking about Down Below Station. So why did you pick this book?
Cool. Yeah. So this was a book. So CJ Cherry is a big name in sci-fi, but somebody who I had never read any of her books at all. And so I was like, oh, this is the perfect opportunity. I was looking through the Hugo's list about stuff I've not read before. And I'd only read, I think, you know, before this book, probably 30, 31, something like that of them. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty that I have never read before. And so I just went, I went to see sort of which authors I wanted to do. And I wanted to try to not do a dude if possible, because they're, or not do a white dude if possible. But I also wanted to read something I'd never read before. And so it seemed like a good choice because CJ Cherry is somebody I've always been interested in reading. I never got around to it. And this is kind of, I've heard a good entry point to her work. Like this book is a good place to start. For her stuff. And it won the Hugo. So,
So, I mean, with that in mind and your spoiler aversion, are you comfortable doing a non-spoiler synopsis of the book?
I could try to do that. I
mean, it might not satisfy your.
That's fine. You know, I know. I'm a weirdo. We have a whole episode about that on my podcast about how much of a weirdo I am about spoilers. So this is a story about interstellar politics and war and refugee crisis and a moment in history that is very dangerous and fluid, and a lot of different things can change, and a lot of societies could find themselves destroyed or totally remade. And it's set in particular on a space station, or in and around a particular space station, which is like kind of a self-contained society with its own culture and its own traditions. And the space station is in the middle of this like vast interstellar conflict. And over the course of the book, we're going to get a lot of different points of view, different people, a different, you know, positions in the conflict, out of the conflict, committed to the conflict, committed, like hating the conflict, you know, all kinds of different views. And so it's like high politics, space war, but it's also very sort of personal because we're always, you know, getting a very close view of like these sort of individuals involved.
Yeah, that makes sense.
What would you add to that? I mean, I'm trying to be vague on purpose, but.
I mean, you're right. It is, there's definitely a political angle, but it's also kind of, I saw it described as military science fiction, and I'm not sure I agree. There's a couple sort of action-y scenes, but there's even one scene where it just kind of takes place entirely off screen, right? Like, if you think about the way the book starts, you know, it's in the aftermath of something terrible happening to another station.
Yeah.
And that's where the refugees come into Pell Station. That's what it is, right? It's around Pell's star. And this is where the name comes from, right? They call the station up above and the station that's down on the planet is called Down Below.
Yeah.
And so the whole thing is kind of Down Below Station. And yeah, it's It's hard to describe.
I agree with that. I don't think it's definitely like sort of gesturing at military sci-fi. There's a lot of characters who are in, there's like very important characters who are in the military, and there are some number of scenes that are, you know, that scene could be like in a different, like if that scene occurred in a different totally hardcore military sci-fi book, like then you wouldn't be surprised. But it's just right. that there are only so many of those scenes, and then sprinkled among them are a lot more other scenes of people who are civilians doing civilian things. So mm-hmm. it's kind of a mix in that way. But I could see why someone would talk about it. Like some of the most, like from my impression of this book is that like after I read it, I looked into some of the, you know, like sort of fan reactions and like what people were saying about it, especially like back in the day. And apparently a lot of people, you know, kind of glom onto Signe Mallory in particular.
Yes.
So I don't know if we're going to move into spoiler land at some point, but that's one of the characters. I haven't given away anything yet.
For normal people anyway.
Yeah. Right. And she happens to be in a military. And so my impression is like a lot of people have sort of, you know, she's a fan favorite and kind of people often associate this book with her. So that may also be why people talk about it as a mil sci-fi book, just because of her. That character.
Right. I was looking at some of the history of this book, and it was kind of written as an introduction to a book that Cherry had either already written or was planning to write. And then this one ended up exploding out to 500 pages. And it was kind of to introduce Signe Mallory. And so I guess that's one of the things that, it's probably worth mentioning even in non-spoilers that you have the whole prelude to the book is about the kind of expansion out from Earth and how, As people went out from Earth, they established stations around different stars because they didn't find habitable planets, but they wanted places that were kind of, locations for trade, right? So you could be in a system that was really rich in metals or something. And so they could have a station that was chiefly doing mining, right? And so they would trade with that station. And it just happens that then they started finding planets with life on them. And that changed some of the equation. And there was some development of technology too, where they have the like faster than light jump kind of capability now. So the stations aren't quite as crucial probably as they used to be. And so you have the Earth company, I guess. So you have the company fleet and you have the Union, and the Union is the kind of the further out stars, past down below station, past Pell. And they're coming into conflict, and Pell is this kind of neutral ground. But the precipitating event is this, is the war, the company war, that dumps a bunch of refugees onto Pell Station, and that starts everything into crisis mode, and everything explodes from there. So, and I feel like that's not too spoiler, probably too much for you, but.
Yeah, well, whatever, that's fine.
And Mallory is part of the company fleet, right?
Yeah, yeah, she's a captain of a warship.
Right.
The captain of the Norway.
Yes. And I think she's the main character of that next book, which is called The Alliance Rising.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I hadn't heard that sort of giving her background was like the impetus for writing this book, but it makes sense because there's a sense, even as you read, I think that she is almost more important of a character than the amount of screen time she gets might lead you to think.
Yeah, when you think about like if you diagrammed the character arcs, you know, a lot of them are like, this guy's the black hat, right? And then these guys are like super good. They never do anything wrong. And then there's Signe Mallory, who's more in the gray areas, right? Where she's, you know, she's somebody who has a reputation for brutality. And so she actually has some, I feel like she has some growth in the book. And maybe we can talk about that more in the spoilers.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. So how about, you know, overall thoughts? What'd you think?
I liked it. I think my overall reaction was the first half or so of the book was slow for me. I didn't, there were things I liked about it a lot. I think the prelude like was awesome. But after the prelude, prelude, from the end of the prelude to like the kind of almost exactly middle of the book, I was feeling like, you know, I wasn't really being pulled along that much. I was kind of like, you know, not loving it, but not hating it. And then it started to pick up a lot. And by the end, I really liked it. I would definitely read more in this universe, more Cherry books. And yeah, I think it's interesting because part of the reason I was kind of maybe not completely invested right away was because I kind of almost didn't know what to expect. Like I was feeling a little bit like, I don't know where this is going to go. This could go in a lot of different ways. I don't know how dark this is going to be. I don't know what I should be expecting. And so it was really interesting. Like I almost kind of could relax as I began to see like how it was going to go. I could kind of relax a little and kind of just sit back and enjoy it. It's not as nihilistic as I was afraid it might turn out to be at like the 1/3 through mark, you know, because the setup could go in so many different ways. And that is one of the strengths of the book, you know, is that it's kind of written, in a way that's very sympathetic to like the vagaries of real history and real politics. Like in the real world, like things can turn out all kinds of ways and you don't know. And that's a reality of human existence. And this book kind of has that sense, you know, baked in.
I found myself going, so we're all humans here, right? So what are we fighting over exactly? Why can't we all just get along? You know,
I know, right?
And it's naive, I know, to think that, because of course all humans don't get along right now. I had a similar experience to you, and I actually tweeted out that like it's not great when you're 200 pages into your 500 page book you have to read for the podcast and it's not quite grabbed you yet. I thought that preface to the book was fantastic and it kind of set up the world, and I've read Citeen already, and so that's some of the setup for that one as well. And then through the first couple hundred pages I was like, I'm not sure I care what's going on here. Because you know, even at the end of the book, I'm like, I didn't strongly take sides with the union or the company. Mm-hmm. There were individual people that I was kind of like, okay, I'm rooting for them. And more than anything, I was rooting for the people on the Pell station to get through it.
Yeah. I think it was tough. I sometimes wondered to what extent, like, I was being set up to feel a certain way and then not feeling that way. But I think that bothered me more in the first half of the book. Like, toward the end of the book, I began to feel like, okay, I get what this is trying to do. It's not trying to make me feel like, oh, I need to, you know, pick one of these sides necessarily. Right. I guess I could. It's just trying to like make me sympathetic to certain individuals, and in particular the station people, and in particular like you know, some of the named characters. And that's, and I'm fine with that. That's kind of the one interesting wrinkle with that is Signe Mallory herself. I'm sure we'll talk about that more, but.
So before we move on to spoilers, how about we talk about kind of in terms of recommending the book, who would you recommend it to? Like fans of other titles, movies or books? Can you think of any comps for it?
Yeah, totally. To be honest, the first thing that I thought of that's like a recent thing was almost The Expanse. And I think, you know, this is definitely like, it's different. There's like differences that are important, but in terms of this sort of epic space opera with lots of gritty politics and like low sort of fantasy elements, like not a lot of fantasy elements, you know, like in other words, it's not like Reality Dysfunction, but it is more like Expanse. Do you know what I mean?
And everything's kind of on a knife edge, right?
Where you're like, a lot of tension.
This could go really badly at any moment.
Yeah.
Because there's always, in this book, there's always the looming threat that, well, one or the other side might decide to just cut their losses and destroy Pell Station.
Exactly. And it would be so...
I guess that's more for a spoiler section.
But yes, no, you're totally right. Like that's kind of like one of the strengths of the book, as I was saying. Like, it's really good at creating the sense of history is a living thing, and the contingency of events, you know, being really subject to just like tiny changes, you know, could cause really big changes in the outcome here. So I think that's one that comes to mind for sure. Another one that came to mind a little was like some David Brin, although I think David Brin is kind of more, it's less like gritty, I guess, in some ways. It's more like his books are a little bit more, like they do have this sort of elements of like politics and people on different sides and sort of like, you know, how is this going to turn out? And then the reason I thought of him in particular was because of the aliens. it's not really much of a spoiler to say that there are non-humans in Down Below Station. On the planet Down Below, there's a native species that is humanoid and sort of similar in some sense to primates. And they're like low tech. And so that it reminded me a little bit of like uplifting like monkeys, uplifted monkeys or something like that. Just a little, you know?
Mm-hmm. For me, yeah, I wrote down The Expanse. A little bit with the politics kind of stuff. I thought Dune maybe, but it's not nearly as hard on the politics as something like Dune is. And then I wrote down Total Recall and Jason Bourne just because there's layers of memory cap thing going on. Especially both the story behind Total Recall and the Bourne book, the original, the Bourne Identity, because there's layers of, wait, who actually am I in that book?
Oh, that's interesting. I've never read that book.
More than in the movie.
Cool.
Though I prefer the movie, I have to admit.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Yeah. And Total Recall, you know, is based on the story. We can remember it for you wholesale. And in that one, there's the whole previous memories having been implanted or written over and coming out. So.
Yeah, totally. I do think also one other thing is just that the preface was very like Foundation-y to me. The preface was a lot like an Asimov short story about like Foundation universe in that it's describing this sort of like epic sweep of history. That's one of the reasons I thought it was awesome too. Did a very good job with that. Better than Asimov in many ways, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. It might be a good idea to just launch right into spoilers just so that, you know, we don't have to worry about anybody's sensibilities.
Cool. Yeah. Well, in that case, I'll just say, spoiler alert, Sidney Mallory's kind of character arc didn't completely make sense to me. And that was kind of the one thing about the book that I didn't understand. Like, not didn't understand, but like it was my one kind of like, you know, source of slight dissatisfaction, I guess. Like I did like this book and I would recommend it, but I think her character arc was the thing that made less sense to me than a lot of the other things that happened. I'm just not completely sure why. So I don't really understand why she was like in Maisian's fleet in the first place. Like what was her original sort of motivation for being a captain and putting her life in the situation it was in? And then I also don't understand why she threw it all away or like, you know, turned coat or like however you want to describe it.
It I don't feel like that decision is super well developed. It kind of comes out of left field.
And it's almost like it's one of these situations where it felt a little bit like, okay, this is a character who, you know, the author seems to really like. And so the author wants this character to have like certain beats happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it almost felt like that. I don't want to, you know, I can't know what was going on in Cherry's mind, obviously, but it was a little bit of that sort of, you know, almost of a Mary Sue situation, although it's not really. Sure. Sidney Mallory is morally gray enough that it's.
Yeah.
And I think we're meant to think morally gray enough that it's not really that. So that's maybe the wrong phrase to use, but.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah. I was trying to think of what her arc was because she starts off being kind of out for herself. And like you said, she's part of Maisian's fleet. And you're like, for what purpose? And I had gotten the impression that fleet was just kind of very loose. And it was like, you're part of us, but do your own thing. You know, you can have your own culture aboard your ship. And then once you end up with that martial law situation, right, then you end up with the conflict between Mallory and Maisian trying to press her into his mold, right? And say, hey, you know, send your people down for shore leave, you know. And she's like, no, what you're doing is you're working people to the bone and then you're releasing them on the station and they're getting into trouble. You need to do something different. He's like, nope. You need to do it my way.
Yeah.
And so there's the seeds of the disagreement between them and she's kind of kicking at the goads a little bit there. And so I feel like that's the only bit of character arc she gets is that, well, it's not even really character arc. She stays true to who she is. She's not going to be pressed into this other mold that Maisian wants to press her into. I think I said press into the mold too many times there.
No, that makes sense. I that's kind of how I felt about it too. I feel like there's a kind of a sketch of a like an emotional landscape for Mallory. We're kind of like given some like sort of hints about like how she might be thinking, but we don't really strongly get a sense of what she wants, like, or what she, like, where she's starting out from. And where she thinks she's ending up, it's very like kind of close third person without access to her mind a lot of the time, mm-hmm. where it's like we're sort of seeing, we got a camera that's like on her shoulder, like looking where she's looking, but we're not seeing any of her thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a looser third person.
Yeah. So there aren't enough moments where you see her sort of thinking revealed. There's a couple of things that I think are meant to do that. Like one is the thing you're talking about where she has this disagreement about how to handle shore leave. And the other is when, what's his name? Damon.
Yeah.
Constantine. When the Constantine brother who's on the station, I guess it's, yeah, Damon, when she has access to him and she chooses not to like, just like have him killed or like have him, right. you know.
Thrown out the airlock.
Yeah, something like that. That's clearly meant to be a sort of humanizing moment for her. But when that happened, I didn't completely understand why she did that.
No.
And so I had the same problem with that moment that I had with her eventual sort of turncoat moment. Like,
yeah.
Why didn't she kill him? I don't know. Like, she's supposed to be so brutal, like, and she does some other brutal stuff. Like, I also kept thinking about the way that she treated the union guy.
Josh Talley.
Josh, yeah. She treated him like shit, right? Like, am I wrong? Like, did she?
No. No, there's even indications that she had him as some kind of a sex slave.
Yeah, right. That's what I kept like almost doubting my own memory of that bit, which that comes in the beginning of the book. And by the end of the book, right. Like I almost felt like the book was like totally ignoring that, like by the end.
Right.
To the point where I felt like, did I remember that right? Like that did happen though, right? Yeah.
Well, part of it is, you know, Josh is sort of an unreliable narrator of his own story, right? Because he had been captured and you find out late in the book, and this is major spoilers, that he's actually from Cytene and is a, you know, kind of a vat grown human, conditioned human, Jason Bourne type almost.
But, yeah, so, totally Jason Bourne.
And he's had his memory wiped at least once. And so what does he remember? Does he remember that he had, I think it is explicitly stated that she abused him in some way.
Right. Because he has a lot of his actions after that point relating to her seem to be driven by this like sort of deep trauma that she caused of some kind. And it does seem to have been like a sexual thing. And the weirdest thing about that to me was the way that it almost sort of faded. Like the further you got into the book, the less the book seemed to remember that that had happened.
Right.
Like even Josh kind of, his attitude toward Mallory kind of went from, oh, he might try to kill her with his bare hands if he sees her, to whatever, I guess we work together. Which didn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, that's a little odd. So one of the things in this book is there's a lot of characters, a lot of point of view characters, and some of them only get like two little subsections of chapters. And the book is broken down into books, chapters, and sections of chapters. And so you'll get somebody like, his name was Byrne, I think, who has like four little sections that he's in the entire book. And so every time I went back to him, I'm like, wait, now who was that guy? And I had to go out and look him up on the Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
Where he's like from Earth.
Yeah.
So that gets a little confusing for me. And that's where sometimes I think, did we need this book to be 500 pages? You know, we maybe could have cut down on some of this. But she moved all the pieces in such a way that I think if you removed any of those, then it wouldn't work. Let's talk about this. The formulation of the alliance of merchants or whatever it is. Did that just kind of come out of nowhere for you?
That one worked a little bit better for me than some of the other stuff that we've mentioned. I think like that one worked for me because of Elaine, Damon's wife. That worked for me more because of all the stuff about her that we got. We got some, I thought some of the character moments in the first half, for all that the first half like didn't really like move me, like it didn't really like feel propulsive to me, or it wasn't like a kind of pulling me in as much. I still thought that there were some really beautiful character moments in the first half. And one of them was all the descriptions of Damon and Eileen's marriage and the kind of private moments that they have talking, like basically figuring out if they're going to be able to really actually commit to each other, and like dealing with Elaine being pregnant and learning about that, and dealing with the cultural gap between the two of them. I mean, I think that it was just really beautifully drawn. I thought it was the writing was just like excellent. And I think because of what we got from Elaine there and her culture, the stuff that we learned about how she actually thought about things and how that was representative of her culture, that gave me enough of a feeling of like what merchanters are like,
yeah,
to be more willing to buy that eventual move at the end, you know? It almost makes me think that one of the reasons I didn't like the what happens to Maesion's fleet is that the only Maesion fleet person we get POV from is Signy. So we don't really get a sense of like what like life is like for them and what they care about, you know, below a surface level. Cause like we get a lot of like, yeah, they're like really gung ho and super, you know, committed to each other in terms of being comrades and whatever. But I mean, I don't know. That's not enough. I feel like that's not a complete description of what a sort of miniature society of people is really like.
Mm-hmm. What you were saying about Elaine was, it reminded me a little bit, kind of going back to what you were saying about the Expanse being a good comp, because it's like the merchanters are like the belters almost.
Yes, exactly.
And then the station people are almost like the earthers, you know, the planet people.
Yeah.
It's like you're either going to be tied down or you're not.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think honestly, this book, from what I understand, I mean, you know, the whole Company Alliance series has been very influential, and wouldn't be surprised at all to learn that, the folks behind James A. Corey were like inspired by this a lot, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that the merchanters is really like, this is one of the things I really liked about the book was the way that the, station society was described and the way that, the stuff that we get about how station society interacts with the merchanter society. I thought that was really cool. Like I didn't think it was necessarily perfect, but like, I thought it was pretty well done and did a better job of describing the ways that people who experience a kind of like live cultural tension in their interactions with others can nonetheless like work together effectively and nonetheless kind of like have good relationships, even in the presence of that sort of tension. You know, you've got like Elaine and Damon are a great example of that, but there's still also like the way that they're able to interact with the other merchanters on the station, the way that some of the merchanters can be relied on and some of them can't. And some of them are like sort of, some of them have been like co-opted by union people and most of them haven't. And like, it does a pretty good job of kind of capturing the fluidity of people's allegiances, even within the context of them living in these different cultures and maybe not 100% understanding each other. Mm-hmm. I thought that was cool. What did you think about the Hisa?
I love them. I'm a sucker for like that kind of portrayal of innocence almost, where they're, you know, I want to say they're simple, but it's not so much that, right? They have their own way of living that can be, of course, frustrating to the humans because they do that thing where like they're perfectly happy to help the humans and work really, really hard. And then spring hits and it's like, okay, we're out until the fall. And we're not coming back. We're gonna go make some babies and then we'll come back and we'll happily work for you and give lots of hugs and
I love. To me, the innocence thing isn't the thing that I'm a sucker for. I'm a sucker for the like over the top affection, you know?
Yes.
The like constant, like the Hisa greet humans by saying that they love them. Like,
yes.
And like they say goodbye by saying, I love you. And they hug a lot. And it's just like, that warms my heart. I love that. I think I'm willing to accept that. I could imagine people kind of reacting in a lot of different ways to the Hisa. I could imagine some readers would be annoyed by them.
Yeah.
Just because of the things that we've just talked about, like the innocence and I could imagine a certain kind of reader looks at the Hisa and is like, that's impossible. They would never be that naive, you know, or like something like that. I don't think that's true. I think it really is the case that there are a lot of different kinds of relationships that might be the default for between species. That said, I think one criticism of the Hisa that occurred to me as I was reading it was the sort of racial aspect. Like there's an implicit kind of, I mean, okay, there are different species. So like literally they're sort of racially distinct in some sense from the humans.
Sure.
And there's a kind of caste system that results from this. You know, the Hisa are not human and they only do certain kinds of simple manual labor. And, you know, the presence of this caste system will naturally remind a lot of actual real world human readers of real world human caste systems and slave yes. societies. I think the book doesn't necessarily want us to think in that direction about this.
Right.
I could understand easily why some readers would just have no, like not be able to not see that all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like that might see that the author is trying to say, see, primitive society should just be happy to serve the more technologically advanced ones.
Right.
And I don't
right.
think that's what she's saying. Because even among the Hisa, right, they don't just blindly follow all humans. They know that there are good humans and bad humans. And they particularly attached to this guy Bennett, who has died kind of sacrificially in some
yeah,
way.
Yeah, he died trying to save Hisa. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're very attached to the Constantine family.
As they should be, because the Constantines yeah. are perfect people.
They are. Well, with an exception, I will say that, you know, Angelo's handling of John Lucas leaves much yeah. to be desired. Because it seemed like, you know, the entire impetus for John Lucas being the Black Hat is mm-hmm. nepotism, right? That basically
yeah.
he got everything started on down below station, and then Angelo sent his son down there to take over. Like, here, yeah. you get to take it across the finish line.
I that's definitely true. And I think that this was like another really interesting thing, because I think John Lucas had some sort of legitimate criticism of Angelo, but also like a lot of his own version of events was very self-serving. He yes. quote unquote got everything started, but actually it sounded like Bennett did most of the real work.
Yes.
Yeah. So
how and dare also, you come and usurp the thing that I was usurping.
Yeah, exactly. And also like John Lucas's version of getting things started was not necessarily great. Like the things that he added yeah. to the down below society, the functioning of down below, were a kind of egregious disregard for Hisa opinion.
Yes.
You know? Which
yeah. And that's where like the crucial thing that comes into this book, where the correct character choice is compassion and love. Mm-hmm. Because you have Emilio and I keep wanting to say Mason, but it's not. It's Damon, who both, you know, are very compassionate toward the Hisa, right? And want them recognized as citizens of Pell.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the right choice. And Damon also taking Josh under his wing because he feels bad for him. He's like, mm-hmm. you know, he comes onto my station, has been treated really badly, and is begging to be lobotomized.
Yes, exactly.
Like, yeah, how do you react to that?
Right.
How do you treat that person afterwards?
Yeah. I thought that was very interesting. I think maybe the biggest, like, it kind of relating to the stuff that I was saying about the Hisa, I feel this sort of complicated, I feel a little bit of like, there's a thing about this book that's dated, that mm-hmm. struck me as particularly dated, other than the treatment of how Signe treats Josh, which seems extremely dated and maybe wasn't good back then either. But the one yeah. thing is that there's a way in which this book depicts people who are like lower down in the social hierarchy as sort of like, if you are a good character and you are lower down in the social hierarchy, that means that you still support the social hierarchy. You may want to advance on it, but you will not. You none of the sort of good lower caste people have any kind of revolutionary feeling or have any kind of like
right.
anger about their situation. And that's mm-hmm. a little bit like, I think that's honestly a kind of naivete on the part of the book, so to speak. Like.
Sure.
It makes sense. Like, I can understand why you might want, for the sake of, you know, if you want to create this alien race that seems defined in large part by this kind of like beautiful, compassionate impulse, and you just want that to be like you want to like create this sort of role model almost for humans in the form mm-hmm. of this alien race that is motivated by compassion. I understand that impulse. Because I like that. I like the idea of having a sort of compassionate role model, but I think part of the power of the compassionate role model is the contrast between that and the tension between that impulse in human life and the very natural impulse of despair and anger. Josh's character is a little bit closer to this. Is a little bit closer to like a realistic kind of vision of somebody who's low caste. You know, like part of not having all the power in real life means anger and despair and kind of like definitely the impulses of anger and despair and the like rejection of the hierarchy itself. And the idea that the Hisa and like other low caste people don't feel any of that is a little, doesn't quite sit right. Even though they're not human beings and they're, I think it's an attempt to create something that's just different. It still doesn't quite sit right because it almost feels like, part of the message might be like, oh no, the better way to be low caste and struggle is to struggle within the hierarchy and like totally not feel any of those negative feelings. And that's
right.
It's just a little, it de-emphasizes and like kind of ignores this big part of the actual human condition, which is, you know, feeling profound, like negative feelings about being in that position. I don't know. That was a long-winded way of saying, that is the thing about this book that kind of bothered me the most. And it has to do with the Hisa. It also has to do with Josh a little. And, but then you also get like, you know, Aline, I think the merchanters feel similar. The merchanters kind of feel like they are considered low caste by stationers. There's a sort of a mutual feeling of the merchanters feel very put upon as a society. And I think that is given more screen time by the book than like any kind of similar feeling felt by any other similar sort of put upon group other than the stationers themselves.
Sure. Yeah. And kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about, I maybe felt that the formulation of the alliance was out of left field. But when I think about it in the context of what you're talking about, you know, that feeling of, hey, we're kind of considered second-class citizens on these by stationers and these other fleets, but without us, everything grinds to a halt. And kind of they're coming together and realizing what their power is and, and going, hey, if we want to, we can make life very miserable for people on stations by not transporting any goods and you know, forming a blockade. So you guys need to listen to us and we're going to set the agenda here.
Yeah. I think that does make sense. And I think I felt like there's an element of self-regard missing from the Hisa in a similar way, you know, I mean, cause the Hisa kind of, when they're motivated to do things, it's mostly only because of humans. They have a very human centric kind of attitude all the time, which doesn't really make sense. I think, sometimes Satin and Bluetooth will sort of like they have a relationship that exists like outside of human world, and that's cool.
Yeah,
and like they will sometimes make decisions that are about them and their relationship and not about humans. But a lot of the time, the Hisa, especially on the station, like they just like there are certain humans they love, and they're just like entire attitude is like, how can we help these humans we love? Yeah. And I don't know. It's just it felt a little bit like okay, yeah, this is how low caste groups should behave. Like, look, this is what they should do, like this. And it's like, well, no, I don't agree with that.
Yeah. Well, I feel like there's some justification that you can understand given that the Hisa kind of have this religion built around the sun, which is, you know, obviously a pretty common thing. And the humans are like the ones that deliver the sun to them because they take them to up above, right? So they can see the naked sun.
Right.
And so I think that kind of puts them in the eyes of the Hisa that elevates humans to this place where it's almost they have a reverence for not all humans, but for the ones that, you know, are kind to them.
Yeah. No, I kind of get the reason I'm kind of a little bit like wishy-washy about my statements here is because I get what there's a version of the Hisa that I think is doing a thing that I like a lot. And I actually just realized what that is. It's the Children of Time thing. So we read Children of Time is a more recent sci-fi book.
Adrian Tchaikovsky, right?
Yes, Adrian Tchaikovsky. Thank you. It is a story. I highly, highly recommend. Great book. And it features some non-human aliens who serve, among other things, to kind of highlight a kind of moral view of the universe that is like specific and that like maybe the author feels is good.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to that is an approach that It's an interesting move on the part of like somebody writing a sci-fi book that features like aliens in it. And it's like a kind of a classic sci-fi move. Like, okay, we're going to create this thing that's not people, but it's going to like work in a certain way that like people could work like that. Why don't we, you know? A lot of sci-fi features aliens as the villain, but sci-fi that doesn't feature aliens as the obvious villain often will do this. And I think that there's something like that that's trying to go on here, and it just doesn't quite do it. And I think instead, like its failure mode is that it ends up being seeming kind of almost racist or like at least extremely tone deaf to like the actual reality of being low caste. Whereas something like Children of Time is sort of trying to do a similar thing, but I think does it a lot better. Do you know what I mean?
I haven't read it yet, so
Sorry. It's so
I'll
good.
I'll get to that one in due course.
You'll really like it.
I don't consider that a spoiler, though. So
Okay.
My
sorry.
Spoiler threshold is higher than yours.
Okay.
So I do have it, though. I do have the book. So one of these days I'll get to it.
Oh, you'll like it. Based on what I know about what you like, you'll like it a lot.
Yeah. Nice. So I was hoping you could help me clear something up. There's Let's a character, the capital D Dreamer. Mm-hmm. How was this introduced?
So the Dreamer, I think, just refers to Alicia Constantine. Right. I think the Dreamer is how the Hisa conceive of Alicia, because she seems to be
because
different.
Because she's bedridden.
Right. Because she's bedridden, and all she does is watch the events on the station on this bank of monitors in front of her.
Yeah. Okay.
And so she's sort of like, they conceive of that as the like literalization of a person like dreaming, like watching images from elsewhere, you know, but her dreams are real. And like, you know, she's like the ultimate version of a human to the Hisa who like worship humans. She's the sort of ultimate version of a human. Like she's the kindest of all the kind humans and like the most sort of closest to the sun of all humans and the like, you know, kind of wisest and most in tune with prophecy of all humans or something like that.
Okay. That just, it like, I came across that part of the book. I can't remember if I mentioned this when we were recording or not, but this is the second CJ Cherry book I've done. And I'm 2 for 2, not finishing it until 2 o'clock in the morning before recording or early in the morning. and it's kind of going back to what we were talking about, how it started slow. And I didn't make the progress that I wanted to make. And I finally reached out to you and said, hey, just set a date and I'll get it done. And it happened that I came into yesterday and I'm like, I got 150 pages left and I gotta read this after dinner. But yeah, I came across that section right when the worst, there's always that breakover point when you're like in college and you're trying to pull an all nighter to study. And there's like that. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got a different point where it's just like, I can't do this. And then you get over it and you're like, I'm good all the way through. You know? And I finally got there, but I read that portion right when I was really struggling and starting to do touch and goes, you know, and before I decided, hey, I can't fall asleep if I'm standing up, and read the rest of the book standing up.
Oh man, classic.
So yeah, thank you for clearing that one up for me.
No, totally. Yeah, no, I've absolutely been there. I think we've all been there. Yeah. So another thing that I thought was really interesting. So this is my first CJ Cherry book. And I thought it was really interesting. There's a really interesting way that there's a combination, I think, of like gritty politics and like history on a knife edge kind of attitude. And then on the one hand, and then on the other hand, these sort of like larger than life figures, these sort of like almost like great people type figures. Sidney Mallory is one. Mazian himself is another one, I think.
Yeah, I picture him holding a swagger stick.
Yeah, that works. Yeah, absolutely. I picture like a close-up of, like, you know, you ever see Evangelion, the anime? Do you know?
No.
Oh, well,
no,
anyway.
I'm not an anime person.
Okay, well, there's a character in that named Gendo who is sort of, anyway, it doesn't matter. I picture him like a sort of close-up of Gendo's eyes with the hands steepled in front of his face. But
there we go. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's these great people, you know, within this like gritty political narrative. And the Constantines, I think, are also meant to be a sort of like a whole family of great people. Like they're all so great. Like, I think there's an interesting tension kind of between these things. Like on the one hand, we have these sort of like larger economic forces of history that are being described in the prologue and that we see some like individual moments of. On the other hand, we have these like individuals who, like Sidney Mallory, just by her actions, changes a lot. Like by her decisions, like the whole balance of power arguably is shifted. And you could say the same about John Lucas as a you know, black hat version of that.
Yeah,
it doesn't quite work out for him, but he certainly almost it almost did. You know.
Yeah.
So what do we think that there's any kind of like? Were you satisfied with the way that that balance is struck in this book between these individuals who are maybe, you know, larger than life figures who have this like larger than life ability to affect the course of history, and then the sort of bigger forces that are dealt with a little in the beginning of the book, and then kind of we zoom in so much we don't see them as well. Did it make sense to you? Did it feel like it was realistic? Did it feel like it was not realistic?
Well, if I zoom in on one part of that, and just on the John Lucas part, right? He's this guy who is aggrieved by something and sees the winds blowing a certain direction as like, I think I can use this to my advantage, right? And helps precipitate this riot that lets him kill his brother-in-law. I mean, that's the other thing we haven't even talked about.
Yeah, that, straight that, up murder.
Yeah, the dreamer, Alicia, is John Lucas's sister. And so, yeah, he goes full Brutus right there, taking out Angelo. And it's one of those kind of curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal things, I guess. And but then he, if you're, I guess this kind of goes back to Dune, which, have you read Dune? Okay. Where Baron Harkonnen at some point says, never trust a traitor, even one you make. And that's what I feel like with John Lucas. I'm like, okay, you hitched your wagon to these guys who are more dangerous than you are.
Yeah.
Hoping that they were going to support you when in fact they're running you now. And so are you shocked that you ended up getting shot in the face? You shouldn't be. So for him, I felt like, yeah, that all wrapped up in a nice bow for me. The rest of it. Yeah. I don't know.
I think the reason I was thinking about this was mainly because of Mallory and because of Maisian. I mean, one thing, Mallory and Maisian, I think in particular, like what I sort of wonder, like, so Maisian is supposed to, like, up until the events of the end of this book, Maisian is like ruling Maisian's fleet with an iron fist.
Yes.
And he just kind of like runs the entire war. And the entire war is just like about whatever he personally happens to want or be, you know, strategizing in favor of. And then like, there's this kind of moment where he loses control, and in particular, he loses control of Mallory, and everything kind of like, everything shifts. Like it's this like massive fulcrum moment. And the more I think about it, the more I think the book did a pretty good job of, originally I was like wondering if I was going to like how that was going to turn out. Cause I remember in the beginning of the book, I was like, this guy Maisian, all right, he sounds like too good to be true in a way, like too powerful to be real. Like, but I like how, I like the way the book navigated the balance of like these sort of individuals who are larger than life and kind of really compelling as almost like superhero type characters. They're not superheroes at all, but they're Napoleons, or they're, you know, Nelsons, or they're Caesars, you know, they're these like great people, capital G, capital P. I think the book did a pretty good job of kind of describing the movement of history in a way that felt realistic, that in a way that also involves large forces as well as individuals and their decisions. I don't often feel that way. I think a lot of books that try to do this sort of high politics, especially high politics in not Earth, you know, in a totally new setting, don't do it as well. Like, I thought that was a really good thing about how this was written. You know, it felt like the individual's decisions kind of could affect things, but like, in a way that was kind of limited and contingent. Like Sidney Mallory, like, could have turned coat at some other moment and it wouldn't have mattered at all in the same way. It just so happened that it happened at just the right time. And this other thing also happened, and this other thing also happened. And so events turned out as they did, you know?
Yeah. I think that was, you used the phrase, like a fulcrum moment, right? Where at that moment, her decision there upset the entire apple cart for Maisian.
Yeah.
And then he's like, all right, screw it. I'm out. We're going to Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you feel about some of the other characters that we haven't talked about? So the Constantins, for example, are you like, were they too good?
They're maybe a little too good, but I don't know. I mean, I did feel like there was definitely a stark contrast between the Lucas company and the Constantines.
Yeah.
And some of the Lucas henchmen, right? Like Hale and
so vile, you know,
whatever the other guy's name
is. Some of those guys are so vile, or like the guy that, so Kresich, his like guy that he worked with, That yeah, guy?
That's who I'm trying to think of.
Yeah, I don't remember his name.
He begins with a C.
Yeah, he was a real piece of work.
Yeah. Yeah, where even Kresik is like, boy, if I don't do the wrong thing, or if I don't do the right thing here, or the wrong thing, I guess, in this case.
Yeah. This guy's going to...
Then I'm in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was like a puppet.
Yeah. I thought the Kresik stuff was pretty cool. The way that was set up was really cool. Like, the way that the refugees worked was really interesting, and I thought it was relatively well done.
This kind of takes me back to talking about the Constantines, right? Where they're portrayed as being super good and everything, but did Angelo do enough for the refugees?
Yeah, I mean,
I feel like he did as much as he thought he could,
right?
But I'm not sure that he did everything he could.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that's one of the reasons he's pretty well drawn as a you don't get a lot of him. And you don't get a lot of what he literally does. He's mostly off screen, kind of, and we kind of are meant to infer things that he's done.
Yeah.
But he definitely seems to care, and it's just not clear that it was enough at all. It seems like it wasn't enough. But it's also like, what could anything have been enough, you know?
Sure. Well, and I didn't get the impression they were going to do anything. And then Mallory came in and forced his hand and said, you're taking these refugees, or I'm going to open fire on your station.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think the most interesting thing about the Constantines to me was the choice to make it so that all of them were legitimately good and legitimately on the same side. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really any tension among them. There was a little like Aline, Damon marriage, you know, sort of marriage tension, but like that was handled really well, I thought.
Yeah.
And in general, it's like Emilio and Damon were like, they didn't really interact much, but like you got the sense they're in lockstep, you know, and like Angelo too. And like, so they form this sort of core group of like they form this sort of like core protagonist, like unit.
Yes.
That you never have to sort of doubt. Like maybe you doubt in the beginning before you get the picture that that's how this is going to work. But by the, you know, last third of the book, it's like, yeah, they're a team. They're solid. Like we can just sort of, like if something bad happens, it's not going to be that they betray each other or that they disagree about something. And that's a definite choice. I think a lot of other books of this sort involving this kind of politics don't have that. Or they don't have it for as long, or it's not as reliable of a thing. And so it's interesting. Yeah. It was an interesting choice. I think a lot of the sense of maybe they're too good comes from the fact that they're like so solid, like they like internal to them, there's no issues really, except for Aline and Damon, but that kind of gets resolved. I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you think that worked for you?
I think it worked in terms of the kind of manipulation that an author can do on a reader to say, in case I didn't state this explicitly, these are the people you're reading for, because they absolutely were. And if they're not the most well-drawn characters, you know, I can forgive it.
Yeah, no, I should say, like, I really like about this book the fact that there is a protagonist or like multiple protagonists who are not, who like, though they have conflict or not, you know, anti-heroes. Like, I like a sort of old-fashioned hero, you know? And it was very appealing to be able to say, like, yeah, Damon's going to try to do the right thing. You know, that's just that's the kind of guy he is, you know? He might not succeed,
except he spends the last third of the book, you know, working on the black market and stuff to survive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, what choice did he have?
But you can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just cool because, like, on the one hand, there's, you know, you could imagine a version of this book where every character is Signe. Do you know what I mean? Where every character is kind of like
Amos from The Expanse.
Right. Yeah. So it's I like the fact that there are these like sort of strong protagonist figures. It makes the book like, and it's interesting because I didn't know it was going to be that way. Like a lot of my kind of feeling in the first third of the book was like, oh man, when's the next shoe going to drop? You know, when?
I think it's about time to move towards final thoughts.
Cool.
Yeah. So like I said, you know, this is definitely not one of my favorites of the Hugo winners. I think I like Cytene better than this one, just because it goes into more of the genetic manipulation stuff that you get a little hint of with Josh and whatever his name was. Began with a J, not Jessup, something like that. Jassad.
Yeah.
I think it was. And you get a lot more, tons of detail about that kind of stuff.
I'm looking forward to reading that.
And that one I feel like is more interesting, but it is substantially longer than this one. When I read it, it was like 650, 700 pages, but it was like the size of a thesaurus.
Yeah, I've heard that it was split. I mean, there's a split where it's multiple books. It was like made into multiple books, sort of like a Neal Stephenson thing.
Yeah, definitely. So, but you know, even though this one was hard for me to get into, I did end up enjoying it. You know, I think I rated it like 3 out of 5 stars on Goodreads. So it's, you know, it's a good book. I'm not sure her writing is for me.
Interesting.
But so you know, I don't know that I'll continue the series. I might maybe pick up the next book that follows directly after this one on audio just to, you know, just to see what happens with Sidney Mallory.
Yeah, that's cool. I was going to ask you about Citeen. I know Adrian has said that he really enjoyed Foreigner, which is a whole other... I mean, I think it's sort of technically in the same universe, but it's so far removed in time and space.
It's a massive universe, though.
Yeah, it may as well be a different universe.
Yeah.
So it's not really related directly to any of these things, but he enjoyed that. That's a whole other... And that's the interesting thing about Cherry is that she has this sort of like vast corpus of books that are like all at least loosely connected to each other, which is kind of cool. I always like it when authors try to do these like really ambitious things like that.
Yeah.
I kind of felt like, in my opinion, of the book changed from the first half to the second. I definitely would read other of her books. I'm looking forward to checking out more of her books. I think, in terms of the sort of writing style, it felt like a tighter, more propulsive version of David Brin to me. In that, I think like his stuff that I've read at least is a little like, I don't want to say slow, but it's a little like the pace is not the pace of a thriller. It's the pace of like a slow exploration. And sometimes it's definitely exciting. There are exciting things that happen, but it's also just like, it's not interested in being a thriller where every chapter is like, you know, cliffhanging you into the next one. And I think her books are a little tighter than Brin, but this book is a little tighter than like, I don't know, Star Tide Rising or whatever, but it's still got that kind of almost like languid pace throughout big chunks of it. And so that's going to just not appeal to some people. You know what I mean? I think. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would say, I think with both Citeen and Down Below Station, if I wasn't reading for the podcast, I probably would not have finished either of them. I'm glad that I did, but you know, I'm willing to pull the ripcord on a book if it's not working for me. And, you know, I've set myself this task. And so there's some books that I'm going to finish anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I did, but I wouldn't feel real bad about it if it wasn't for the podcast.
How would you fit it into your rating of all of the all of the Hugos? At least ish.
I mean, it'll be in the lower third. Third. You know, there's no books here that I've been like, that was garbage. So even like Neuromancer was one that is a classic. I just didn't really enjoy it. And so it's almost on the bottom for me. And I think Star Tide Rising was was the same kind of thing where it's like, didn't work for me. Still a good book, I guess. and lots of people like it. But yeah, nothing where I'm just like that was terrible. But yeah, this one's not going to be in the upper half. And that's okay. Something has to take last place.
That's true. Something does. If it's going to be a force ranking, there will be a loser.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. I read on the Wikipedia page that there is a folk song written by Mercedes Lackey, who is a well-known fantasy author, entitled Sidney Mallory.
Yes, I saw the reference to that too.
Would you listen to that song?
I would. Yeah, I'd be interested.
I have not. I maybe should at least do that before I ask these questions. But I thought that was interesting. That was like a... It's really interesting to me the way books like influence like the broader culture or whatever. Like I love talking about that. And so I was very interested to learn like how much a certain kind of person was into Sidney Mallory as a character and how influential she's been. I think definitely there's an idea in my head that she's like a relatively early, like in terms of really famous, influential sci-fi characters who like influenced the sci-fi world and like the larger world maybe a lot. Sidney Mallory seems like this sort of somewhat earlier female antihero, like badass female antihero type in a way that I think a lot of people responded to, it seems like, at least. So that's kind of interesting to think about the impact that that might have had.
Well, we should both look and see if we can find that song. And when I post the episode, when I put it up on Twitter, we should report on that if we find it.
All right.
Well, Matt, I definitely want to thank you for joining me. It's been a pleasure. It's always nice talking to you.
Oh, totally. I love doing this. This is really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a different feeling. I was telling my wife about this. There's a different kind of nervousness that comes when you're talking to someone brand new, which is almost all my episodes, where when it's somebody that I'm like, well, I've already talked to Matt. This is fine. I'm not even sweating. So,
yeah, no, it's good because, you don't necessarily know, like, if they're going to totally hate all the things you like or something like that,
right. Right. Well, in this, this podcast, I rely so much on my guests to bring what they thought about the book in. If I don't have a lot to talk about, who knows how it's going to go. So I really appreciate your being prepared for this and finishing the book, weeks before we actually talk about it.
Well, so you say that, but I like I said, like the first half was kind of a slog, and up until like percentage, like 51 or 52 on my Kindle, like I was really concerned. I was like, oh, this is not going to be fun. Why did I suggest this? But then it got a lot better. So I felt better. Yeah.
Well, Matt, where can people find you?
People can find me at spectologypod.com and at spectologypod on Twitter. Those are actually run by my lovely co-host, Adrian. But I will certainly, if you wanted to reach out to me directly, I would certainly see any of that stuff. And if you wanted to get involved with Spectology, I certainly encourage you to do that. It's available on any podcast thing. It's called Spectology, Science Fiction Book Club Podcast. So, welcome everyone.
Yes, and I second that endorsement for Spectology. You guys do great work over there.
Thanks, Seth. You too. I really enjoy your podcast too. Like, I don't honestly listen to a lot of book podcasts just because I feel like a lot of the ones I've tried are just not for me. But yours is, and like the other one is the Jenny's.
Oh yeah, yeah. Reading the End.
Those are kind of the ones I listen to. I mean, maybe there's some more good ones out there that I don't know about, but there probably are. But love it.
I'm quite happy to be mentioned in the same sentence as the Jennies. All right. Well, thanks again, Matt. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Seth.
We'll talk down the line.
Yep. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Matt. And if you haven't already done so, do go check out Spectology. They do a great job over there. They cover a lot more recent stuff in science fiction, like Matt was saying, and they just do a wonderful job. And so I can't recommend highly enough that you check them out. Of course, as always, I want to invite you, if you're enjoying this show, to go and rate and review us in whatever podcast platform you use. That would be great. If you would like to financially support this podcast or take me to your reader or brief and not so brief, you can head up to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up to support me there. That would be fantastic. But even if you don't, I want to say thank you so much for listening. I've been doing this for 3 years now, and I'm still really enjoying it. And I'm about halfway through. So here's to the next 3 years. And I will talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.